Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and we're going to continue with our analysis of an excerpting of the book Blood Oath, subtitled A Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson. The book was co-authored by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers. It's published in softcover by Rainbow Books, copyright 1996. This book concerns the allegations of an anonymous informant codenamed Skinner, who maintains he was part of an elite white supremacist strike team that murdered Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, framed O.J. Simpson for the murders, and did so in order to not only divide blacks and whites and heighten racial tensions in the United States in hopes of igniting a race war, which would lead to the ascension of the white supremacists to the pinnacle of power, but also to discredit and amend the legal system and to discredit law enforcement in general and the LAPD in particular. Basically, a Nazi psyop. This operation was backed by unnamed foreign terrorists, probably a German Nazi terrorist, but that's not made clear, and involved sympathetic elements within law enforcement who provided tactical intelligence and also directed the investigation in the direction of O.J. Simpson. And this particular operation was designed in order to celebrate the 10th anniversary, according to Skinner anyway, the 10th anniversary of the Order's assassination of Denver talk show host Alan Berg. This operation also supposedly began, or the attempt to ignite a race war with the abortive attempt, abortive because it was discovered by law enforcement, to attack the African Methodist Episcopal Church, in the AME Church in Los Angeles. This group also, according to Skinner, had murdered Brett Cantor, a music producer and nightclub owner, because he refused to market a white supremacist band called Rahoa, and in particular was apparently contemptuous of that. He was also a Jew, and according to Skinner, that group murdered him. Indeed, O.J.'s defense team had cited the almost identical murder of Brett Cantor to the similarity between the Brett Cantor murder and the murders of Nicole and Ron, and according to this informant, indeed, Brett Cantor was murdered by the same group. We are going to deal next with not only the nature of the strike team, but how the group was able to plant O.J. Simpson's blood, according to Skinner anyway, at the scene of the crime. One of the most chilling aspects of the account presented here, and that concerns the elite military and law enforcement backgrounds of the people who were in the strike team. Now, again, none of the strike team members is identified by name, and indeed it was Skinner's desire to express to the strike team members his abiding loyalty to the group, and he did not want any of them to be arrested. Still, he felt that the operation itself was, he had a change of heart, and he felt it had to be stopped. That is, the desire to ignite a race war and to inflict terrorist casualties on Americans. The membership of the group, and again, this is an elite six-man white supremacist strike team, part of a blind cell, is described as follows by Skinner in the account. Again, Skinner's a code name in the account presented by the authors. Conversation was low-key, dominated by cautious idle chatter designed to mark time for what they all knew would be a historic planning session. Make no mistake about it. This assembled gathering was the cream of the crop. Ex-Green Beret, Special Forces, law enforcement officers, survival specialists, and military officers. All were consumed with a common hatred for elected authority and non-white races. They were a very dangerous group to be reckoned with. Indeed, and the deliverer, their leader, was a former high-ranking officer. So indeed, note that they were ex-Green, this would seem to imply that in addition to ex-Green Beret, perhaps active duty special forces, although that's not clear from the context, and law enforcement officers, survival specialists, and military officers. Indeed, given the consummate military and political capabilities of elements like Green Beret, Navy SEALs, and so forth, their presence in a white supremacist organization and as part of a white supremacist strike team is extremely alarming. Again, I want to note in the aforementioned Specialized Knowledge and Abilities series, The Special Forces Underground, who published The Resistor. It's not clear if they are white supremacists, but certainly their rhetoric is very similar to the rhetoric of white supremacists, and they might be, for all we know, and they express an open contempt for democracy. Again, a very alarming development. More about some of the background of some of these strike team members. Of the Deliverer, Skinner says, I couldn't help but think of how he had a way with words. Hell, this was no hillbilly. The Deliverer had held high rank in the military. He still looked good, and he talked even better. So again, apparently the Deliverer was a former high-ranking military officer. And still more about the Deliverer. And here there's discussion of the contention that some of the strike team members had apparently been veterans of covert operations and had performed assassinations as part of covert operations for the government. Of the Deliverer, Skinner speaks, and the author's right. He started to swing the laser dot in a slow, lazy circle, like a spider entwining his prey, entrapping it in a web from which there was no escape. The Deliverer smirked weirdly, his face contorted. Then he said softly, timing is going to be the most difficult part of the effort, unquote. And again, quoting, split-second coordination, very similar to the assassination some of us have been involved in for our government. But now it's for our cause, and in the way I've conceived this plan, surveillance and timing are the most critical parts of the operation. So again, it appears that members of the strike team were indeed covert ops veterans. Still more, and this concerns one of the members who was to be conducting surveillance, again, what is described here as the enemy camp. That, of course, is OJ's place as well as Nicole's. One person could walk through the enemy camp uncontested, gathering intelligence as he posed as an everyday obnoxious sightseer, camera in hand. The surveillance teams would not walk into this battlefield blindfolded and unprepared. This was no ordinary tourist, but a brilliant, disenchanted ex-Green Beret ranking officer. So indeed, this is an exceedingly formidable group of people with extensive background in covert operations, assassinations for the government, etc. Beyond that, their equipment was extraordinarily sophisticated. They conducted electronic and physical surveillance on OJ's place and Nicole's, tapped both of their phones, had an electronic monitoring system on OJ's intercom, had decommissioned that, or had utilized that for their electronic surveillance, I should say. They had infrared equipment, video equipment, a secure mobile communication system, communicators, their communications were scrambled. This is a highly sophisticated team. They used intelligence methodology and highly sophisticated law enforcement and intelligence equipment for this operation. They even burglarized OJ's home after the Northridge earthquake, according to the account presented here. More about that in a few minutes. Of the extraordinarily sophisticated equipment that this highly sophisticated and very dangerous team had, quote, it's going to require the use of night surveillance equipment, infrared lenses, telephone taps, cellular phone scanners, remote listening gear, personal communicators, video cameras, including some of those miniature ones we just bought from a security catalog. The selection of the evidence left for the frame will depend on the circumstances and on our opportunities. 9 months of hard work should provide some situations and chance events that we can take advantage of. Codename Blade, another member, spoke up after studying the chart for a time and making some notes. Quote, to ensure that the timing sequence is synchronized between OJ and Nicole, I suggest that we have two teams in constant communication via our secure mobile systems, unquote. The Deliverer was pleased. Quote, now you're thinking ahead. That's what we always have to do to stay in front of our enemies. That's great, unquote. Speedy looked a little confused. He asked, quote, how do we get the cops to find our evidence when we want them to, unquote. The Deliverer replied quickly, quote, I guess you forget about our kinsmen inside the LAPD and the LASD. We can't forget our Trojan horse we talked about. Those kinsmen have been extremely active in our behalf. And again, that's a segment that I read earlier. More about the equipment that this group had. And again, it's a highly sophisticated array of equipment that they had. Returning once again to Blood Oath. And this is some of the description of their equipment while they were enjoying a feast cooked for them by Margie during the planning session. Again, Margie is the wife of the deliverer and a member of the group. The cabinets carried more than just dishes for food out here. Each team will be taking with them what I've previously described, the ultimate in intelligence-gathering equipment. You'll have night vision equipment both for visual and photographic purposes. We've obtained wristwatch cameras and cellular phone scanners with audio intercept capability. Also, remote miniature audio and video recorders with transmitters, police scanners, and hands-free personal communications devices, including micro headsets containing transmitters, receivers, speaking tubes and earpieces, and various other transmitting goodies. Let me show you this mini camera. It's truly unique. A compact camera system about the size of a pack of cigarettes. Thumper looked at the unit placed on the table by the deliverer, remarking, "But how much definition does it provide?" "How's this?" asked the deliverer while turning on the mounted TV. "Damn, that's unreal. Hey, Skinner, look how clear the picture is." Anyway, the point is some very, very sophisticated equipment indeed by this very, very sophisticated and well-trained group with an extraordinary background in law enforcement, the military, and covert operations in particular. One of the things that this group also had were a couple of Westech security jackets. Westech Security was the firm that was handling security at OJ's place, this for some of their reconnaissance operations. And again, quoting, "I'm giving the enforcer a couple of Westech security jackets we've had made up for this occasion. They're copies of the real thing. They're gray and have the words Westech Security in patches embroidered on them. That's OJ's security firm." The enforcer held one up. The deliverer pointed to it. "I took some pictures during my early scouting and had Margie whip them up. Never hurts to be prepared in case the situation arises." And again, this concerning the sophistication of this particular operation. I would also note that the group was able to burglarize O.J. Simpson's place. Again, they had it. They had O.J.'s place under surveillance. They were able to burglarize O.J. Simpson's premises to take some Bruno Magli shoes, a watch cap, and also a pair of gloves, which they speculate may have actually been gloves of Jason Simpson and not O.J. as well. That is the explanation for the fact that the gloves didn't fit. And indeed, the group members, when they were watching the trial after the operation, were surprised that the gloves didn't fit. And that is, at least according to the account presented here by Skinner. More about the group's burglary of O.J.'s place in order to obtain some of his items of clothing in order to frame him. "Our break of the century, or as I call it, a windfall, occurred January 17, 1994, when the Northridge earthquake hit the area." By the way, I believe it was actually January 19th. I'd have to check that. I believe it was January 19th, 1994. I believe this is a misprint. "It scared the expletive deleted out of some of the kinsmen who had never experienced one. This 6.8 shock gave us an opportunity to slip into the fortress and gain access to his bedroom upstairs. He wasn't home, and the maid was all that stood between us and our snooping. We told her we were assessing damage to the phone system. Quickly, we planted our leading edge technology bugs into OJ's phone system. We also installed a miniature transmitter in the alarm keypad unit. Two of these pads were easily located. One was just outside the maid's room. The second outside and to the left of the front entrance where we planted the bug. This bug ultimately sent the security code to our recorder so we could get in to plant evidence and remove the bugs after the hit. Our intrusion also permitted the extraction of some of OJ's personal items that we felt met the deliverer's requirements. A pair of dark brown leather gloves that looked like they had been worn, a couple of pairs of black socks, a watch cap, and expensive sports shoes. My attention was drawn to these expensive Bruno Maglis. Grip asked, 'Why those? How will they help identify him?' Unquote. Who else could afford to wear shoes like these to murder someone? I was in one of those discount clothing stores, and the shoe salesman tried to interest me in a pair of them. One of those Jew salesmen. He said it was a great deal, worth at least $160. Can't go wrong, unquote. I wouldn't buy diddle from a Jew. The prosecution will be thinking Simpson from the start, unquote." Grip agreed and added, quote, "Did you ever see such a neat freak? These closets and drawers were like something you'd find in a clothing store. Neat, lined up, and full of a variety of clothing. Our ability to get inside allowed us to plant a rather unique telephone interrupt device into his system. All of O.J.'s utilities ran underground into the fortress and required access to the main telephone connection inside. By the way, the fortress is the team's nickname for O.J.'s residence. This location also served as the home for another bug. The device would allow us to temporarily disconnect all incoming and outgoing calls. While they were out, a message would be activated notifying the caller that there was a temporary problem which would be corrected shortly. An old telephone serviceman's trick was used to determine that the bug was working and that O.J.'s number was 476-4619. Cato's 476-1706 and Arnell's would not be deactivated. Or Cato's and Arnell's would not be deactivated. On our way out, Grip took one of O.J.'s trophies to be used at a later date to prove our involvement. Upon discussing this later with Grip, his explanation was, quote, "Remember that Kennedy case in Florida? The girl took a vase or something to prove she'd been there. In the meantime, he'll blame one of the workers he hired for taking it," unquote. The group also bugged Paula Barbieri. They were also conducting surveillance on Paula Barbieri and apparently planted a bug in her car as well, although they were interrupted in doing this and then relocated the car, which was reported as stolen. Returning to Blood Oath, on one occasion, the enforcer who was following her saw an opportunity to place a homing device and voice recorder in her vehicle. He was interrupted while in process and opted to drive the vehicle to a safer location. That was almost our undoing, as Paula came back sooner than expected. In his haste to abandon the vehicle, some of the deliverer's notes on Nicole's movements in late 1993 were dropped. Our uncanny good fortune continued to prevail as the enforcer slipped away. She reported her car missing. By the way, later the car was recovered, and notes talking about Nicole's schedule were indeed found in the car. The problem grew each day of our watchdogging. I decided to ask the deliverer for advice. His decision was to cut back the day-to-day intelligence gathering. For the next 2 months, most of our information would be collected by our telephone and intercom remote recorders. We scheduled pickups of the tapes every other day. And skipping down still further, upon her return, Nicole's telephone-recorded conversations indicated a romantic involvement with a Ron Goldman. I'll never forget the raging anger that spewed from Blade when he heard the name Goldman. That nigger-loving mother, expletive deleted, is now involved with a kike. Let me be the one to slit her throat in the name of our glorious Aryan heritage. I have taken an oath to destroy traitorous enemies such as her, unquote. He continued to rant, and his face contorted as he exclaimed, "This is the very same person who the deliverer claims has German blood running through her veins. The righteous solution will be to drain her body dry of her Aryan heritage," unquote. And again, that following allegation of a romantic involvement between Goldman and Nicole may very well be true. I have no way of knowing one way or the other. Apparently coming, according to the account Skinner presented, from the bugging of Nicole's telephone. I'm going to repeat a passage I read in the last segment. In addition, of course, to law enforcement personnel, Skinner, the informant for the authors, also maintains that the group had people in forensics labs providing them with intelligence information. Quote, "We need to get information about O.J.'s doctors and plan visits for checkups. I'm talking to some forensic lab people who are kinsmen. I gained an insight into some other items that could be used in the frame. One of the guys checked a legal database he had access to." And apparently, according to Skinner, the group was able to obtain a sample of O.J. Simpson's blood from a, quote, kinsman, unquote. That's the cause's terms for fellow Nazis or white supremacists. So again, when you hear the term kinsman, that is their internal terminology for their comrades in arms or fellow organizational members. According to Skinner, they were able to affect the frame of O.J. Simpson by planting some of his blood at the scene of the crime and then also at O.J.'s place. Alluding to the failure to ignite the AME operation, the deliverer here, actually the enforcer here, codenamed Enforcer, holds forth as follows. "Who couldn't forget how the bleepin' BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms members, and their cousins, the FBI, nailed some of our suppliers? We got lucky because they missed our guy. He was a key player then, and now he's going to be an even bigger one. He supplied us with most of the machine guns and plenty of ammo. He's a totally rounded person, a Renaissance man with a chemistry background. He knows how to make a bomb. We talked about using one for that church deal, but that damned FBI infiltrator blew the whistle before we could consider it. Lucky we didn't discuss his bomb with the snoop. Quote, "You can be sure the day will come for his bomb. Maybe this guy is real strange, or maybe it's just what he does. He was telling me about his work one day while we were downing a couple of cool silver bullets in a little beer joint in Oxnard, California. This sucker works with blood for a living. No, he's not a vampire. He not only works with it, but he can tell you who the blood belongs to by doing some crap to it. He said it was a blood fingerprint. I think he mumbled something about being a DNA specialist. He was telling me how this DNA got some people out of the pen by proving that their blood wasn't the same as the blood found at the crime. The DNA stuff creates some sort of picture of who blood or saliva or sperm belongs to. Who'd ever think after you screwed someone they could pick you out of a crowd? Hell, he said this DNA is capable of finding a needle in a haystack. It was during a torrent of his cursing out niggers, Mexicans, and Jews when he told me about someone's blood that he picked up. Now, who do you think that blood belongs to? O.J. Simpson. That big nigger has an arthritic condition and takes all kinds of medications for it. He goes in for checkups all the time, and these checkups include blood tests to check the drug levels. He joked of dreaming about what the blood was made of. What was it really made of? Was it mud, or did it just make mud children? Normally, they get rid of the blood. He saved it as a souvenir, like a trophy. Could we have been more fortunate? I'm sure we can get him to give up his trophy for the cause. With his knowledge of blood, he'd be the perfect one to take charge of the blood part of the frame. So according to the information here, the blood specialist who obtained a sample of O.J.'s blood had been the weapons supplier for the failed operation against the AME Church, and apparently he got away. He is also further identified, at least according to Skinner's account here, as having worked at Cedars-Sinai Hospital, and this, according to the account presented by Skinner, was how he was able to obtain O.J.'s blood. By the way, he's codenamed Colby. That's his code name here. Speaking of bleeding, and this is Blade speaking here. Speaking of bleeding, how is Colby doing with that sacrificial blood offering of O.J.'s? Thumper piped up, "Yes, Skinner, how's that part of the plan going? And by the way, how did he get the code name Colby?" "Thought you'd never ask," I replied. "He is one mother bleepin' cold bloody bastard. I wouldn't mess with him. Strong like an ox and quick tempered. Get it? Cold bloody Colby?" I couldn't tell if he believed me or not, but it was the truth. From my private discussions with the deliverer, I knew Colby had stored O.J.'s blood in the medical lab where he worked. He was also going to try to obtain a fresh supply. He had access to the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center at 8700 Beverly Boulevard and other labs and centers in the area. Blood samples and whole blood would be taken to this facility and stored for tests for possible future transfusions during surgery by Simpson's personal doctors. We were assured by the deliverer that either the blood he already had in his possession or a fresh sample would be ready when the operation was in its final phase. A vial or two removed from O.J.'s surgical supply would be the best source, free of telltale chemical preservatives like EDTA. Again, I want to note before we present the last excerpt that I'm going to do in this segment that it is the suspicion of the authors that there is some disinformation in here, so that certainly should be factored into the assessment of this particular work. However, I personally believe that the vast bulk of the information in here is accurate. There may be some disinformation, and indeed the informant Skinner indicated that he was deliberately obfuscating some things in order to protect the identity of his comrades in arms. There is speculation that perhaps the Colby, this blood and DNA specialist, might have been Stephen Garrett Colburn, a white supremacist indicted on a weapons charge, who was an acquaintance of Timothy McVeigh's, initially was a suspect, although later was not a suspect in Oklahoma City, or was not indicted for involvement in the Oklahoma City bombing. And I would also note that Stephen Garrett Colburn, white supremacist, a weapons aficionado, and acquaintance of Timothy McVeigh's, was, in fact, a blood specialist and DNA specialist at Cedars-Sinai Hospital at exactly the time period required to obtain O.J.'s blood, and O.J. was being treated there at this time. Just as the Oklahoma bombing, returning to Blood Oath, just as the Oklahoma bombing was the catalyst for our informant coming forward, coincidentally, it was also the catalyst for the arrest of Stephen Garrett Colburn, 35, alias Bill Carson. Colburn had been employed as a DNA research associate at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center from mid-1993 through October of 1994. It was during that time O.J. Simpson had surgery there. Colburn was arrested by federal marshals on Friday, May 12, 1995. Mr. Colburn failed to appear in court on October 21st for a July 20, 1994 weapons charge that involved the seizure of a knife, an assault rifle, a silencer, and two loaded pistols, one of which was a 9mm. The seizure took place in Upland, California on Route 83, less than 10 miles from the Chino Airport, where a couple with the last name Nadal, N-A-D-A-L, kept a very strange airplane. Christian and Doris Nadal, or Nadal, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, lived in North Hills, California, about 10 miles north of the scene of the murders in Brentwood. They were involved in the bombing plot of the First AME Church of Los Angeles and maintained an airplane with a swastika on its tail at the Chino Airport. Colburn is known to have expressed pro-Nazi sympathies with references to the Third Reich and was extremely anti-Semitic. He held a hatred of women, Mexicans, and non-whites alike. U.S. Marshals described Colburn as armed, dangerous, and trained in survival skills. When arrested in Oatman, Arizona, he kicked a marshal in the jaw and attempted to reach for a gun and knife in his back pocket. The trailer he lived in was searched and revealed several cases of ammunition, including cases holding link belt rounds for machine guns, along with cases of handguns and rifle bullets. Colburn admitted knowing Timothy McVeigh, the accused Oklahoma City bomber. On July 17, 1993, in an article titled "More Suspects Sought in White Supremacist Plot," the L.A. Times reported that investigators for the AME case, quote, are trying to trace those weapons, which may lead them to additional suspects, sources said, unquote. The weapons in question were dozens of machine guns, revolvers, sawed-off shotguns, bayonets, and pipe bombs. The agents also discovered stolen medical supplies and some very interesting paperwork, unquote. Colburn frequently traveled back and forth between Bullhead, Arizona, and Los Angeles using routes 10, 15, and 40. Route 10 runs very close to Chino, while Route 40 runs directly through Barstow, both on their way to Los Angeles. By the way, Barstow was the strategically located point of the planning meeting for Operation Thunderbolt. Could the authors go on to ask, could Colburn have been, quote, Colby, unquote? Or was Colby a clever code name standing for the West Los Angeles Police Station located at 1663 South Butler, bordering Colby Avenue? And again, some of the superficial circumstances surrounding Stephen Colburn suggests the distinct possibility that he may have been, quote, Colby, unquote, the blood and DNA specialist who, according to Skinner, obtained the sample of O.J. Simpson's blood. But again, that is speculative. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.